Welcome to the Lion Zone, where you'll learn to be a lion and not the prey in a world of hungry jackals and vicious wolves. I'm your host, Steve Johann. For more about me, visit stevejohann.com and find me on Substack under stevejohann.substack.com. I've got another great show lined up for you, and tonight I normally like to bring in, I like to bring in people on here, and I've got a great guest again for you. But before I do, I'm going to play a song to kind of introduce us to the show. So here we go. And we'll click that.
You know, it's sad, so sad. Our young men and women just throwing their lives away. Now, people out there, you know it's not right, 'cause it's not supposed to be that way. Hey, hey, all right. Hey, hey, hear me now. I'm tired of being alone.
All right, so that is, do you know who that might be?
The OJs? I don't know.
Yeah, it's got that feel. That is my friend Moody Scott. Moody Scott is a musician. He that came out in the late 60s, and he redid it. He's got his own CDs out and that, and he lives in Vegas with his wife. And just a really cool guy. I've known him for about 12, 14 years now. And occasionally we talk, and I thought I want to share a little bit about his music because you, John Hankey, we're a public school teacher, and that kids might get down when they're in the public schools, but we should not give up. And that song, by the way, is Bustin' Out of the Ghetto. I want to introduce my guest. His name is John Hankey. He is a former public teacher. He spent 30 years in the L.A. school district where he taught gifted children. And now he has been retired for, I think, 10 years, and he's moved into investigating history, also known as revisionist history, which is just another way of saying going against the mainstream narrative. He has put out documentaries, and he's got his own channel on YouTube called John Hankey, and we'll discover if he's got an actual website as well. I think I went over and I couldn't find it. So, John, thanks for coming on with me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to having a good time.
Well, that's great. So tell me, first of all, do you have a website that's separate than your YouTube channel?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm afraid I focus on making videos. I've been doing this for, 20 years at least.
Okay.
My first video was called JFK2, The Bush Connection. And it was a huge hit on Netflix. It had a million hits, and they would take it down, and somebody else would put it up, and they'd take it down, and somebody else would put it up, and they'd take it down. And this is 20 years ago. So this phenomenon of Netflix suppressing stuff that they don't like.
Are you saying Netflix versus YouTube?
I'm sorry. YouTube.
Yes.
I remade it and called it Dark Legacy, and Netflix carried Dark Legacy for 10 years, and it's about the Bush connection, right? It's about George Bush's connections. There's like 12 of them to the Kennedy assassination. He's mentioned in two different FBI memos, both of which are entitled Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, one of which puts him in Dallas that day.
CIA. He was ahead of CIA.
Not at the time. At the time, he was, At the time, his official CIA cover was that he was an independent oil contractor from Houston. And you can find that him saying that all over the place. He told it to the FBI in his phone call. But many people know who Jim Garrison is. He's the lawyer in the movie JFK. He's the prosecutor in the movie JFK. And, you know, it's a real story, right? He's a real guy, and he was a prosecutor for many, many, many years. And he was used to having very good relations with the police, of course, and getting nothing but cooperation from the police, of course. And he was pursuing this case, and he asked the Dallas police for their arrest records from October, I'm sorry, from November 22nd. And they said, "We don't have any." And he said, "What?" And they were stonewalling him, and he couldn't believe it. But in the process of him conducting all of this work that he did, he got to know many of the Dallas police, and one in particular, Roger Craig, had been deputy of the year in I believe, 62. And, you know, he's a very sharp, competent, honest, hardworking, and brave fellow. And he called him up and said, "Won't you please ask your friends to see if any of them made arrests?" And of course, they're going to remember who they arrested and the details from that day. And he wrote back or contacted Garrison back and said that a Detective Vaughn had described arresting a person as a shooter coming out of the Daltex building, which is right across the street from the school book depository, and the crowd in front of the Daltex building had heard shots from the Daltex building, and they saw some guy come running out the door looking very guilty, and they grabbed this guy and handed him over to Detective Vaughn. And Vaughn says as they crossed the street to the police station, the guy told him he was an independent oil contractor from Houston, which would account for why the shooting from the rear was so horrible. There's like 12 missed shots, right? They found bullets, right? There's bullets in the windshield. There's bullets in the metal rim that goes across the, right, to hold the convertible top. Bullets in the grass, bullets in the cement. And, you know, Kennedy certainly never got hit. They didn't succeed in hitting him from behind, not in the head anyhow. So the shooting from behind was terrible, is the point that I was getting at. But Bush apparently was arrested as a shooter that day in Dallas. Anyway, that's
it never ceases to amaze me the connections built upon connections built upon connections that go all the way back. I remember probably my first inclination that things weren't right was, oh, I don't know, back in early, I don't know if this is post 9/11, I guess so. I was involved with, I guess it was. I was out campaigning for a local guy here in Linwood, Washington, and also promoting George Bush Jr. As president, you know, and to run for president. And I was at a PAC meeting, and somebody handed me this book about the president during that, Theodore Roosevelt. And I'm just reading through it, and then it talks about when he started putting together the FBI and the CIA, and he didn't call them that. And I started going, holy smokes. Ding! Nobody knows what's going on. Everybody's doing their own thing. Only he knew. And then I realized, okay, that's when something just went off in my head. And it wasn't until numerous years later that I started going down the truther movement and going down that. But it was like I read that portion in the book, and that's what hung onto me in the back of my head is, oh, my gosh, the CIA has had free reign to do whatever they want for a very long time. And then you find out, you know, the Dulles brothers and all these people and the nature of these individuals. I call them darklings in my book. They're not good guys, but they're working for the empire. They are working for the empire. They're working for the people who need to keep the empire going. And so they, in their own mind, I suspect, think they're doing a right job. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know what they think of their own minds. It's really, really hard to tell. I mean, E. Howard Hunt, does that name ring a bell?
Yes.
He was the head of the Watergate burglars. He's written three autobiographies that I have studied very, very, very carefully. And my strong feeling is that he's a fascist. He's a Nazi, and he knows that he's a Nazi. He doesn't like democracy. He certainly doesn't like democracy that includes the right of ordinary people to have any say-so about what's going on. And he's very, very dedicated to the billionaires who have helped him along at every stage of his life. But, you know, I think that 99% of people are at least decent, and a really solid percentage of people are, they're good people. They're, if they see somebody in pain, they feel it, right? It hurts them in their heart to see
Yes.
that.
Yeah.
And then you have the small percentage of the population who are sadists who end up running the country. But so, speaking of the empire, let me introduce that, which is to say that 50 years ago, that's not a slight exaggeration, that's on the money. I was a straight A student. History was my thing, and I got A's on all the tests, and I got A's in all my papers. And a friend of mine brings home a bootleg copy of the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film is the film that was shot in Dallas, showing Kennedy getting his brains blown out from the front. And I took one look at that and said, "Oh my goodness, everything I have studied may be a lie. Certainly, I can't believe anything that was handed to me. I have to go back and, with my newfound insight and cynicism, cynicism may not be the right word, but my lack of trust in anything that has been handed to me, I have to go back and reevaluate everything that I thought that I had learned, that I had in fact wasted my time learning." But do you mind if I take a minute?
No, and I want to point out that we've got a lot of things we're going to be covering, but I was down in Dallas with I went down, my son moved to Dallas, and so we were down there visiting, and my wife and I, and so my son and I and my wife, we went to Dealey Plaza. And we walked around. I took lots of shots, video, and everything. And I'm talking, this is like 2 years ago. And I'm like looking. I got this book called Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. That may be backwards. I don't know if you're seeing it that way. By Michael A. Hoffman, and he talks about the importance of. He also had a book called King Kill 33. But he talked about that they had to have it do there. They had to kill, the killing had to go there because it had a lot of Masonic, it had the trident, it had all these kind of things that are right there built into that square. And so I was there taking all these pictures, and there was a guy selling a book about JFK, and I didn't buy it, but I've got his card here. So I have been kind of interested. Years and years ago, a friend of mine who used to host a podcast that we used to do about motorcycles, he used to say, "Steve, that JFK thing was a put up. That so and so didn't do it. There's a lot more to it." And we wouldn't talk. I was like, "Okay, that's cool. I get it." But I didn't chase into it like you and many others. So talk to me what drove you into that, because maybe, I was born in 59, so I just remember it being announced, but I was in a little small town. It didn't affect me personally. But talk to me your story about that, because I think that's what you want to open up.
Well, actually, I was gonna start 1,000 years before, but that's okay.
No, please do. Please do.
Well, but I mentioned, right? I mean, I was always a straight A student, and I know what idiotic things I'm capable of, right? That I don't have an inflated ego, I don't think, but I recognize, some guys can slam dunk a basketball. My son can watch hours and hours and hours of Cosmos, right? Science videos. I can't do that.
I can't do that.
I'll watch one with him and I'm done. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. But I've hit my fill. But with history, I don't hit my fill. And not only do I not hit my fill, but I'm dogged. I read something and I think about it for years, and years later, I will come
Me
back
too.
to something that caught my attention 20 years before and start digging and say, "Oh my," right? I'll think about it for 20 years, and in 40 minutes, I was able to get to the bottom of this rock. But so here I am, right? I'm a really solid student, and this friend of mine shows me the Zapruder film, and I said, "Oh my goodness!" And I went down to the L.A. Public Library the next day, which is five stories; it's huge, and I got every book that they had on the Kennedy assassination, which was at the time, this is 1972, four probably, and brought them home and studied them. But then I started going around and I did presentations at UCLA and at UC Santa Cruz and at my old high school and any place that would have me, a number of community centers. And at my employer, I held a thing for all of the people at my employer anyway. But I want you to focus on the fact that it started with the Zapruder film. And then I had seen little things here and there. But then I had the time, right? I retired about 6 years ago, and I had the time to start collecting all this stuff. There are 20 witnesses, including Walter Cronkite and including Senator Yarborough, who was sitting behind, or he was in two car lengths behind Kennedy, so maybe less than 50 feet behind Kennedy when the kill shot was fired. And all of them, including four motorcycle cops, accompanying the limousine on tape, saying that the limousine stopped for 6 seconds. And Yarborough, the senator, writes about this in his Warren Commission affidavit. So it's not a secret. I mean, people complain about the Warren Commission. And if you complain about the Warren Commission, it's because you're too lazy to read the 40 volumes. But if you read the 40 volumes, you're going to stop complaining because it's all there. The fact that Oswald was an FBI agent is there. Anyway, so that's how I got started. But let me jump back. So a thousand years, and I was thinking in the course recently, but in the course of all of this, right, the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower warned Kennedy about the military-industrial complex. And if you get my video, it's called Breakthrough. If you go to Vimeo Breakthrough-JFK, I think you can buy it, download it for like $4. And you can watch it. You can't watch Breakthrough. You can watch Dark Legacy on Prime. Anyway, Amazon Prime. But I'm sorry, right? We got the military-industrial complex. Kennedy gave a speech at the United Nations, right? The missile crisis happened. And all of Kennedy's advisors advised him to start World War III, that he should launch an attack against Cuba because the missiles weren't ready. And McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, writes about this about 10 years ago, that they got everybody together who was still alive for the Russians and the Americans to discuss the missile crisis. And one of the things that came out to McNamara's real shock and horror was that those missiles were armed with nuclear warheads and that the commanders were authorized to use them, so that World War III would have broken out if Kennedy had listened to his advisors, but he didn't. He told them, they said, yeah, we'll all go to bomb shelters and then we'll attack these things, these bases, these missile installations. And Kennedy said, "I got another idea. You're not going anyplace. So when the war breaks out, you're going to be the first to die. The first missiles that hit the U.S. will be hitting you. So now what do you think? Do you have any alternate plans?" And they managed to come up with the one that they came up with. But the point is that Kennedy and Khrushchev both realized we have to negotiate. We can't. Nuclear war is not an alternative. It is not an alternative. We have to negotiate. And I think I don't want to give too much credit to Kennedy, but between the two of them, they also recognized that, well, if we can negotiate nuclear weapons, why can't we negotiate conventional weapons? And Kennedy gives a speech at the UN that you can see in my movie. Both of them, you can see it also, it's very prominently featured in Dark Legacy, which, as I said, you can see on Prime. And you can also buy it, and I recommend that you do that, because then you have a copy that when they took it down off Prime about a year ago, and then they put it back up. And Netflix had it for 10 years, and then they took it down, and they won't give me the time of day anymore. He gives this speech at the UN in which he calls for the elimination of all weapons and all armies. That is an exact quote. All weapons and all armies. If we can negotiate nuclear weapons, we can negotiate everything. So why are we spending, trillions of dollars on armies and bases and conventional weapons when kids are going hungry and college students are homeless and can't afford and having being forced to drop out and being saddled with this monstrous debt? So, military industrial complex killed Kennedy. And who is that? And so I'm considering this question, and I come to find out that the think about this, and let me invite your audience. You're King George III, and he gets a letter in the mail from those feisty American colonists saying, "We want a seat in the parliament." Right? No taxation without representation. We want a seat in the parliament. How much is it going to cost him? $40 to buy a seat and a chair and say, okay, fine, here, you get one vote. Are you happy? Oh, so, and instead they have a revolutionary war that costs what would be the equivalent of, in today's dollars, of trillions of dollars. I mean, Britain went just enormously into debt fighting the Revolutionary War, and about what? Well, he was pushed into it by the military-industrial complex, who also happened to be the
The
bankers.
bankers.
They also happen to be big pharma. They also happen to be big agro. They are now Google and Netflix, right? And they control all the media. And they've been doing this since 1600, well, 1776, absolutely positively. But how far back does it go? The Hessians. You remember the George Washington crossing the Delaware, and he's going to fight the Hessians, if you didn't know. And if you didn't know, go ahead and look it up. He's going to fight the Hessians. Who are these Hessian guys? Well, they are the preeminent product of the most powerful, well-oiled, fine-tuned machine of a military-industrial complex in the history of the world, run out of Frankfurt, Germany, and completely operated by the Rothschilds. You can look that up.
Yeah, they
Who?
were mercenaries. They were the top gun mercenaries of their day. I
Well,
mean,
mercenaries is, I don't know if that's the right word, because if they got killed, the Rothschilds got paid. So that when Washington is in his boat on his way on Christmas Eve, right, they know that all the Hessians will be dead drunk celebrating Christmas, and these guys come creeping in the middle of the night. I mean, it couldn't be more of a terrorist raid, slaughtering soldiers in their drunken sleep in their beds on Christmas Eve. Good gravy. And it was all money in the pockets of the Rothschilds. And so I'm knocking around, and I don't remember what it was that I Googled, but I wasn't looking very hard, and I find at the Mount Vernon Library, they got an army of scholars, got nothing better to do, and they're pouring through all of these records, and there's lots and lots and lots and lots of them. And somebody finds the record showing that Washington owned shares in the Bank of England, which was owned by the Rothschilds, so that he was a servant. We could spend a show on that. As soon as he became president, he handed the economy over to the
It
Rothschilds.
was, I remember I heard that it was like within 8 years, we had to change the actual, we became a corporation because we had to be owned by the banks.
Well,
We basically had could not pay our debts back, and we became well, basically, I think every country in the world is beholden to those guys. But
oh,
go ahead.
absolutely. Oh, no, the England more than the United States until Washington became president, right? England was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Bank of England and the Rothschilds. But and Jefferson gets and Jackson, Jackson's the guy. But Jefferson tried to fight to let the U.S. have control of its economy. And you in high school, in your history book, you saw a picture of Jackson with a sword and he's trying to kill this Hydra. And the Hydra is all of these banks, which are all owned by the Rothschilds.
Yes.
Brown Brothers Harriman, I come to find out. It's on their website. I couldn't believe this. Brown Brothers Harriman was one of the largest banks in the United States in 1776. And they brag on their website how they were taken over by the Rothschilds. I believe it's 1837. But so I'm thinking, how far does this go back? Because the Rothschilds moved into Frankfurt in the 1600s. And, you know, you can't believe what you read, but you can be sure that the dates that they give are certainly, they're not going to give you an earlier date. They're going to, if they're going to lie, they're going to push the date back and pretend, oh, we didn't control it all of that time anyway. But so in pondering that, I start thinking about, it strikes me one day to ask the question, well, wait a minute, the Crusades is a fabulously expensive proposition, right? You're going to get all of these soldiers. You got to feed them. You got to arm them. You have to transport them. Who's going to pay for that up front? Well, you could very, 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 very accurately call the people who paid for it up front the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial banking complex.
Banking.
And you can be quite sure that, you know, these guys go in and, the Arabs were very, very good merchants. And they were the gateway between China, between the beauty and through the silk, etc.
It's called the Silk Road. The
Silk Road.
And it goes back thousands and thousands of years.
India had dyes and spices,
yes,
and, you know, all these beautifully colored garments,
yes,
right? In Europe, I don't know, they didn't have a lot of dyes. And I don't know if they had any local, and they hadn't figured the technology out in any case. But so the Arabs were able to profit from all of this. And when the Crusaders went in for their first raid, they made enormous profits, and you can be sure who got the lion's share of that. The military-industrial complex of 1,200. And I was doing a movie that there's, I have a couple of movies on Shakespeare as well. And I'm reading this thing about Shakespeare, and he's having his little squabbles with Queen Elizabeth, and King James was, Shakespeare's company was called the King's Men. It wasn't called the Queen's Men. Shakespeare had a hard time with Elizabeth, but when James came in, the week that James arrived in London, he invited Shakespeare to the palace and signed the contract calling him the King's Men. So Shakespeare was a huge, King James was a huge fan of Shakespeare. But so in doing all of this research, I find out that Elizabeth has this, she has a problem that the banks have a stranglehold on her, that the banks have a, and this is, you know, the people writing this book are trying to talk that banking was not their issue and the economy was not their issue. Shakespeare and literature was their issue, but they couldn't avoid making this observation. But so the point is that this stuff goes back a while. And so I'm going to guide that into JFK, and then we can look at October 7th in Israel, because it's the same people. So Bush was in Dallas. He was a leading member of the CIA's Operation Mongoose. All those guys were in Dallas that day, and we know that they were in Dallas. One of the reasons we know they were in Dallas is because Oswald was Hoover's agent, and Oswald was reporting to Hoover about all of this stuff that was going on. There's a really fabulous book called Plausible Denial. One of the leaders of Operation Mongoose, E. Howard Hunt, who was the head of the Watergate burglars as well, his son says that that's him in photos from the grassy knoll. There's just an overwhelming amount of evidence suggesting that E. Howard Hunt was on the grassy knoll. But he and Bush worked together as leaders of Operation Mongoose. The FBI had infiltrated them, and they knew that they were in Dallas. And when an FBI agent, these guys were smart enough that they knew that when an FBI agent comes up to them and says, "Where were you yesterday or the day before?" I mean, the week after the assassination, they were questioning all these guys. If they lie, they're going to jail. But if they say, "We were in Dallas. I was in Dallas. I was in Dealey Plaza. What were you doing?" "Just standing around watching." And the FBI didn't, that's what they were doing there. They were there as a smokescreen. One of them in this book, Plausible Denial, on the stand says that she was told that these guys were there as a smokescreen in order to distract the FBI from who the shooters were. Well, the shooters, it turns out, were the leaders, right? The foot soldiers were on the street to attract the attention of the FBI, but E. Howard Hunt was on the grassy knoll. We have his sons say so and a lot of other input to that effect. And Bush was arrested coming out of the Daltex building. Well, E. Howard Hunt worked for Averell Harem, and he says in the trial, and as far as I know, that's the only source for this information, but he says under oath during the trial that after World War II, while the CIA was exporting, smuggling Nazis out of Germany and into the U.S. and into Argentina and so on, Hunt was working for Averell Harriman in Paris, helping him do that. Averell Harriman was at the time probably the richest guy in the country. But he was Hunt's supervisor immediately after the war. Well, immediately before the war, Bush's father had his bank seized. He was the CEO of Union Bank of New York. And in 1942, Union Bank of New York, you can find this in Google, in Wikipedia, Union Bank of New York was seized as a Nazi asset by the FBI. Well, Bush Sr., Prescott, owned one share of the bank. The other 4,000 shares were held by Averell Harriman. But the bank was a Nazi asset. These guys were Nazis in 19. They funded Hitler. Hitler was funded by Union Bank of New York, among others. But Averell Harriman, we come to find out, when he sets out on his own, geez, I don't know the year for this, and I apologize for that, but it's not the critical point. He threw everything he had, Averell Harriman threw everything he had into Brown Brothers, and they made him a junior partner in Brown Brothers Harriman. And as I have said before, Brown Brothers brags on their website that they were taken over by the Rothschilds in, I think it was 1835. Anyway, and certainly that's very close to being the absolutely correct date. But so the Rothschilds, for the last 50 years, I've had all sorts of people who try to say, "Oh, Israel killed JFK." Well, my ears are perked up and I'm watching, and I've never seen any evidence that I found remotely persuasive. I mean, there's some evidence that suggests, well, they might have had a reason because JFK was opposed to nuclear proliferation. He didn't want the Russians or the U.S. to have nuclear weapons. Why would he not try to impede the Israelis from having nuclear weapons? And he did. All right. So, but you can't tie them to I have never seen anybody do anything remotely resembling what I considered a decent job trying to tie Israel to the assassination. But you can tie the founders of Israel to the assassination. And this is my jumping off point, which is that in 1825, oh my goodness, a former student of mine, speaking of my gifted students, I taught in South Central Los Angeles. I taught the most economically disadvantaged kids in the country. But these are kids who, if they were dumb, they'd have been dead. You know what I mean? There's a natural selection going on the streets of South Central, that if you don't have some pretty good, sharp, in fact, keen senses and intelligence, you're not going to make it And these guys would then walk into my classroom and point stuff out to me that I had never seen, right? We're looking at the Zapruder film, and some kid says, "Look at the driver," and the driver's completely turned around. Well, the Zapruder film, as we learned, the Zapruder film, I probably didn't mention this, doesn't stop. The limousine in the Zapruder film does not stop. The Zapruder film is a fraud.
It's got clips all the way through it. It's not like a steady of, you normally would say, okay, here's a procession of the Queen going by, and they literally keep the camera going on it. That thing is chopped up like nobody's business.
Well, I never detected it. I'll tell you, I
But I
never
mean,
did.
it, go ahead,
But I
please.
can tell you that in 1972, 73, when I was going around showing the video, the copy that I had, you see, Jim Garrison, the Dallas district attorney who's in the movie JFK, who's trying to prosecute one of the local CIA officials who he can. He had some evidence to demonstrate was connected to Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, I'm going to throw in, Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill John Kennedy. So being connected to Lee Harvey Oswald really doesn't, kind of the opposite of connecting you to the assassination. But set that aside, Garrison was doing the best that he could with what he had. And he subpoenaed the Zapruder film. Well, he also subpoenaed Oswald's W-2 forms. Today, you cannot see Oswald's W-2 forms because they would show that he worked for both the FBI spying on the CIA and he worked for the CIA spying on Russians who had come, who Russian defectors in Dallas. But is any the point is that if you can't get the W-2s, how can you expect to get the Zapruder film? You know what I mean, that if you're going to say that there's some sort of sensibility towards the Kennedy family, that we don't want to release this incredibly bloody graphic video, well, that for some reason that doesn't apply here. They released the Zapruder film, but the Zapruder film that they released was a fraud. I was going to mention that when I was showing it, when Kennedy gets hit, there was a huge bloody spray that came out of his head. You can't find that today. Right, I had a Super 8 film that has deteriorated, and it broke into when it was had broken into 25 pieces, just sitting in a box in a cupboard on a shelf. It broke into 25 pieces, but what you can get today doesn't have that bloody spray in it anymore. Anyway, back to October 7th in 1825, the Rothschilds, who at that time were absolutely the lords of the earth, right? They had taken over the Bank of England in 1825. You can look that up in Wikipedia. In 1829, I'm going to quickly throw in, if you've played Monopoly, you know that if a guy owns the board, he's not going to get poorer and poorer as everybody else is wasting their time rolling the dice so that they can then give the money that they just got passing go, paying it out in rent. You're not going to own anything anymore. Anyway, in 1829, the Lords of the Earth wrote a letter to the Sultan of Turkey. One of my students sends me this document, and it's, I mean, I spent 2 weeks researching to try to prove that this was a forgery, and it's not a forgery. This is a very, 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 very legitimate source. And so, you had to stumble on it. If right, if it had been pushed into your face, you should always doubt anything that gets handed to you on a silver platter. But they told the Sultan of Turkey, we want to buy your Palestinian children and the land that they live on. We want you to give it all to us for 300, some fabulous amount of money. And the Sultan of Turkey said, "Excuse me, why don't you sell me your children?" Well, because I don't sell my children. And he refused to do it. And you can then show how the Rothschilds maneuvered and maneuvered and maneuvered and maneuvered. Do you mind a mild diversion right here?
Go ahead.
Talking about the maneuver, but well, how did they start World War I? Well, wow. What started World War I? Well, Archduke Ferdinand was driving down the street when he got killed by an assassin. Well, let me tell you, folks, on January 22nd, I'm sorry, November 22nd, 1963, Kennedy's car was driving down Main Street. And it was supposed to continue on Main Street down to the freeway, but suddenly it turned right on Houston and then on to Elm, going by the book depository where the assassins were waiting for him in an area that he wasn't supposed to be. The Garrison, the lawyer, makes a huge deal out of this. He had the newspaper on his desk showing the
The route.
parade going, not going into Dealey Plaza, not making the right turn. How are the assassins waiting for him in a place that's not on the parade route? Well, so the Secret Service stopped the limousine. The Secret Service turned the car into Dealey Plaza. The Secret Service were the most important operatives at work that day. They could have hired anybody to be the shooter from the grassy knoll. You said you went to Dallas. The thing that I was most impressed by is standing behind the picket fence and seeing that it's about 30 feet from the picket fence to the street where Kennedy's limousine would have been, maybe 50. But I mean, if you're anything, if you had a week to practice, that's an easy shove. And the car is parked. That's a very, 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 very easy shot. Anyway, Archduke Ferdinand was car was in a parade, and it suddenly made a wrong turn down the wrong street where the assassin was waiting for him. Okay, so it was a plot, right? Archduke Ferdinand was killed in a plot that has all the same trademarks, earmarks of a plot that we know that Kennedy was killed in that involved the Rothschilds, that involved the minions of the Rothschilds. So they finagled World War I to start. I watched a 3-hour debate between these English scholars debating what caused World War I, and nobody can agree. The British didn't have a good reason to be in World War I. The French didn't have a good reason to be in World War I. The Kaiser didn't want the war. These guys discussed it. Well, who did want the war? Well, the Austrians, it seems like. And then this same student, or maybe it was his best friend, sends me this other document showing how in 1865, the Rothschilds forced the Emperor of Austria to get down on their knees and kiss his feet for nothing. And what are they going to get in return if they do this? Nothing. And but the Rothschilds demanded that he do it and refused to promise to give him anything in return. Now, I don't know how that story ends. Presumably they gave him something, but they maintained a stranglehold on the Austrian economy since 1865. So in 1914, the Austrians force everybody into World War I. And at the end of the war, right, Jesus, something like 15 million of the cream of the British youth got killed in that war. And another similar figure from France, and another similar figure from Germany, and a much lower figure from Italy and all the other countries. But good gravy. And what did these guys die for? Can somebody explain to me? No, nobody can. None of these scholars can explain to you what any of these guys died for. Nobody wanted the, well, no, hang on. The military industrial complex in Germany was the same people as the military industrial complex in France and England and the United States. Well, those guys made out pretty good during World War I. World War I was very, very, very good for them. But after all of this pain and suffering and slaughter at the end of the war, Britain invaded Palestine. Because, Palestine is such a critically strategic area? No, absolutely positive because of the olive trees. They wanted those olive trees, because olive oil was going to be a thing. No, then why did they do it? Well, you can figure it out because as soon as they invaded Palestine and grabbed it, it's called the Balfour Declaration, Balfour. The
Yep.
Secretary of State, they don't call him that, the Foreign Secretary of England, wrote a memo, and he didn't write a memo to the head of the Zionists, and he didn't write a memo to the head of any Jewish organization. He wrote a memo to Lord Rothschild promising him Palestine.
Yes.
Well, so do you suppose the military-industrial complex today is owned by different people than it was in 1914? If you do, you don't understand how this stuff works. Of course it isn't. It's owned by the same people. And, you know, the war in Ukraine is...
the same thing.
The same. It's to boot. Well, there's important differences. The war in Ukraine is to boost the war profits, the war budgets of every country in Europe, and the war profits of the military-industrial complex that we are all slaves to. So, October 7th. The Rothschilds, I don't think the Rothschilds care if that war kills everybody in Ukraine. I don't think they want to care. They want to kill everybody in Israel. They're willing to kill lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people in Israel. They certainly don't give a damn about the people.
No, they don't. They don't care about anybody.
But you have to have, you know, you've got to have people on the street in order to maintain your claim, right? Oh my goodness. Well, I didn't. We're going to back off of October 7th for a minute. We got plenty of time, right?
I wanted to interrupt real quick. James Corbett of the Corbett Report does a wonderful job of producing documentaries, and he's got one about World War One, and it is. It's the industrial military complex, and they are behind it, and the banking. He points this out.
Can you send me a link to that?
Yeah, I will. So
I will send you an email reminding you to send me a link.
The point is, folks, is now I want you to go. This all plays into the Talmud, Kabbal, Kabbalistic, Zohar teachings that the Rothschilds are so. I mean, this is a religious belief system. I believe they're serving Lucifer, of course, but this is not by accident. I, as a matter of fact, was in a Bible study on Saturday morning, and we were reading through something in Deuteronomy, and it talked about the year of Jubilee, and that's every 7 years there's a Jubilee in the nation of Israel. Now, this is ancient Israel. We're talking 3,500 years ago. And God commands them, okay, every 7 years you are to undo the obligations of one to another. But he says, if they're to foreigners, you do not have to undo your obligation. They still have to pay you the interest and pay you back. And I went, that's in Deuteronomy. Now, that was God directly through to Israel. Now, if you know anything history-wise, they lost all that. God doesn't work through Israel anymore. That's not, Jesus is the fulfillment. He's the promise. And as a matter of fact, the whole entire Old Testament is nothing but Israel rebelling against God and the evil that they did. The point is this, they've cherry-picked sections of the Old Testament, and they've created their own traditions, their own mysticisms that they gathered over the thousands of years, and they've created their own system. And it's interesting because they want to rule the world. And guess what? Financially, they're doing what they wanted to do.
Can I argue with you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. One is that I don't doubt anything that you said, but I think that that's superficial. And, you know, I was hung up at one time on Skull and Bones, and I was hung up at one time on the Council on Foreign Relations, and I was hung up at one time on the Masons, and on another time at Foreign Relations. And those are all tentacles. None of them mean anything. They're just tools.
I agree 100%.
Well, now, in 1916, the Rothschilds and the bankers of London dominated every economy on the planet.
Yep.
Since then, they have lost Russia, they have lost China, they have lost all of Africa, they have lost India. Well, they still, you know, they got plenty of tentacles left squeezing on India, but they no longer get to dictate. They can't send British troops into India anymore to
The ta are
loot, rape, and pillage.
so can I interrupt then? So what you're saying is their quest for world domination is shifting. There's an awakening going on. There's a transformation going on, a transfer of power. Is that what you're saying? Is
They're
that
losing.
that's what we I think a lot of
They
people,
ran the world
they did
in
run the world.
1916.
We're
I'm sorry.
seeing the death throes, possibly. Not the death
Well,
throes,
the
we're just.
horrible part of it is that you and I still live in the slave states.
I know we do.
Well, the rest of the world is getting free, but oh my goodness, the stuff you read in the British press about how the stupid, oh, stupid British citizens think they should have health care and have decent housing and have education for their kids. They're so stupid. We should be giving all the money to the military. I didn't go looking for that, right? That ended up in my mailbox. Anyhow, so they're going to, having lost their ability to exploit at, geez, at will and at to the maximum degree, right? They used to carry on genocides every single minute of every single day in every single country on the planet,
You're right. You're right. And then
to
we,
which Gaza pales in comparison.
you're right. If you look at history, the amount
Yes.
of bloodshed under the different powers, things have reduced. We've seen the United States basically being like the strong arm in the last 20 years in the Middle East, trying to just annihilate all the various countries over there. But you're right. There is a that. The day and age of just marching people off to just wipe each other out is dwindling, is what you're saying.
To say the very least. Now they're
Yes.
trying to mobilize Europe for a war against Russia.
No, it's not going to work, I don't believe.
I don't, well, there's plenty of people. I'll tell you what, you'll never convince anybody old enough to remember World War II that that's a good idea, right? And
No, they
the
lost
British.
themselves. They completely that nation became shattered.
You mean Germany?
No, I'm talking Britain. Became
Oh.
the common people. Britain was, I mean, yeah, Germany of course, but Britain, the.
Well, it's interesting though, because they have to have these elections. And Trump told the Republicans, if you talk about cutting Social Security, you're not going to win the next election. You have to shut up about that. But leave it to me. And they come up with COVID and they pump it into all
Oh
the
yeah,
retirement
they
homes
faked
and
all
they're
that, yeah.
killing. Today, I saw a statistic, I couldn't believe it. Like, 70% of the people who died from COVID are over 75, and 60% are over 85.
Of course.
How the hell does anybody who's 85 years old get exposed to COVID? They're not going outside. If the people who are, if they're in a nursing home, the nursing homes, after all this
It's
time,
it's it's it was this.
well, however it is, you know,
It was the jab.
we can speculate. If I was them, oh, that one of the guys from Oxford, who developed the Oxford vaccine, says we're going to put the vaccine in an inhaler, in an aspirator, right? Just this little thing that you see people with asthma have, and you go, psh, and it emits a cloud of vaccine, and we're going to, that's how we're going to administer the
Jeez.
vaccine. And I think I suspect that that's one of the ways that they administer the virus. Nobody has ever administered the vaccine that way, although, you know, you have this guy, right? He's the head of virology at Oxford. Anyway, so on October 7th, people in your audience are familiar with 9/11. You suppose?
Well, I let's put it this way. I was interviewing Veterans for Peace, and this is a while back on one of my shows, and I talked about the 9/11 was a whole setup. It was used, and they go, "Yeah, that was an industrial military complex that did that." And
Yeah.
I've tried, and I'm like, "Yeah, they used their assets. They used the Mossad assets. They used our internal assets. They used whoever." But 19 hijackers didn't bring down seven buildings. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. I've examined probably 100 hours of documentary tapes. I've read books. I've spent another 100 hours or whatever. I've spent a lot of time. That was my real wake-up call when I delved deep into that one. And I went, there is no – and then I just watched one, and I haven't got it. But you can actually go back, and you're talking about documentation. So they had the 9/11 commission, and it's like a 1,200-page report where they went out and they interviewed eyewitnesses that day. And the video, the documentary I was watching put out by a Canadian who just passed away from cancer.
Name him.
What's that?
What's his name?
I am trying to, I wrote it down at the house and I'm trying to find it. So nonetheless, he said that over 230 documented individuals on that day said multiple explosions, boom, 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 multiple explosions, multiple explosions, multiple, all throughout this thing. You can't, it wasn't boom, hits the plane. No, it was ongoing. And
well,
and when it took it down, and it wasn't, so in other words, what I'm saying is, when you talk about going back to source material, which most people don't, they watch videos and they think they know enough. I do that when in my book, I've gone back and I've got source materials in my book to point things out so that I can back myself up. And I says, if you want to go read the whole thing, here's where you go. But what I'm saying is in that report, we're not calling the NIST report. We're not talking about that. I'm talking about the commission report where they went out. They said there's over 200 people that have said these were all explosions.
Well, so it's like the Warren Commission report.
Yes.
It's full of all these eyewitnesses who say the official story is completely garbage.
But it's so the point is this is I on a supernatural basis, they believe that the guys at the top, if they've given you forewarning of what they're going to do, by the way, and then they pull it off and then they let you know that they did it, then they are guilt-free of what they do. And so that commission, yeah.
That's an interesting way of thinking.
And so that commission points out the facts, but no one's done anything about it.
But no one's done any. Oh, my goodness. Well, so.
I'm just saying. So the October. October.
Bringing it back.
The point is this. Is that prior to 9/11, people were doing inside trading of the exact people, the exact companies.
Oh, and it's very, very well documented.
Yes.
And it's in my video, by the way. You're posting a link to my October 7th video.
Yeah, I will. And the fact is, in your video, you point out, and I had already heard it from somebody else. It was like weeks ago, I was watching, months ago, somebody was pointing out that, hey, they had insider trading going on the couple days before the October 7th attack. And I'm like, you can't put calls and puts a week in advance. You have to do it literally within a very, very short frame of time. Otherwise, you're going to lose out your money. And so these guys knew within a window of time, within a couple days of time, that this event's going to go off. You can't do this. Oh, we're going to speculate months ahead. I buy stocks. I'm expecting it to go whatever. But to do what they do, to short the stock or do whatever, you have to do that within a very short frame of time.
Well,
so tells you that that was planned. That was already carrying out. So go ahead. Talk about your film.
Well, on 9/11, I'm taking a shower and my wife yells at me and says, come in here, you got to see this. A plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. And so I go in and I'm sitting there looking at the TV and a second plane crashes into the World Trade Center. And I looked at her and said, one plane, any commercial pilot will tell you that it was positively impossible for one plane to crash into the World Trade Center. But I know enough about U.S. air defense to know that you can't crash two planes 20 minutes apart into the World Trade Center. And then I open up my newspaper the next day, and the L.A. Times tells me that the plane that supposedly hit the Pentagon hit it 50 minutes after the first plane hit. It takes a jet fighter 8 seconds
yes.
to get from Andrews Air Force Base to the Pentagon, flying at warp speed. You're flying at top speed.
They would have been there within
seconds.
5 minutes.
Well, so October 7th, you have all of these. But we're going to talk about something that you mentioned a minute ago. You have all of these veterans, and they're in my video. Two of them are in my video who worked on the Gaza Strip, who said this is an inside job. And the one of them is just furious. And, you know, you can hear and see the anger in his face and voice about how this is an inside job. And he talks about how there's a very, probably the largest military base in Israel is in southern Israel, about 2 miles from the Gaza Strip. And it's 28 helicopters. And this guy says it would have taken them 5 minutes from sitting at the table drinking coffee, to being in their helicopters firing at these guys trying to cross the fence. It would have taken them 5 minutes. And the New York Times says it took them 7 hours. CNN says it took them 7 hours. I saw a rabbi with a thick Israeli accent saying, "What are you talking about, 7 hours? That's an inside job." This is a rabbi. He's sitting in church saying this. Anyway, I forget who was telling me this. It might have been Jeremy, that he saw some video with some veteran doing that, and he contacted the person who had posted the video, and the person was an Israeli. It was a woman, Israeli, and she said, and he wanted to have her on his show and interview her, and she said, "I can't say any more about it. I'm scared to death. Everybody else is scared to death. Everybody knows, and everybody's scared to death."
There you go.
And, you know, today, nobody, if you stand up and say 9/11 was an inside job, you've had it, right? If you had a career, you don't anymore.
Yep.
Between you and me, I think they went after Charlie Sheen, and I believe that they oh my goodness, they're really good at surrounding you with friends who then do you in. They did that to the Panthers, right? The head of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, Fred Hampton.
Yeah, the fact of Malcolm X being the real dude, the real guy, and you saw what happened to him. And then you're right with the and I only know a little bit about this. I mean, just scratching the surface, but I do know that when there is a group that's actually doing something good, and there's a movement and they're gaining power, you've got to put people inside there. You've got
instantly
to infiltrate it.
They're good at it. I mean, Fred Hampton's best friend gave the FBI a map of his apartment, and they killed him from the sidewalk, shooting through the exterior of the apartment, through across the hallway, through the bedroom wall, into his bed, and wounding him to where they could walk in and he was unconscious, and then they fired on him in his bed. But that was his best friend. And
yes,
I expect they did the same thing to Charlie Sheen.
Because
anyhow,
Charlie Sheen was speaking out about 9/11.
Yeah, oh yeah, sure he was.
Yes. And then all of a sudden he's this crackpot, he's got AIDS and blah, blah, blah. And the next thing, you know, he's got, and not to say that I like the show that he was on, Two and a Half Men, but the fact is, the fact is, he had an awakening. He saw something.
And they destroyed him.
Yes, they did.
And nobody, no politician today can whisper that 9/11 was an inside job.
No, they can't.
Or that the Kennedy assassination was a conspiracy. Nobody.
Nobody.
60 years later, you can't find it, right? If you're not part of the establishment, if you're just, you know, a mucky, I mean, a, what do you call it? What word would you use to describe a couple of guys like you and me?
We're just guys.
Dedicated amateurs.
Yes.
Right. And if you do it long enough, you develop some skills that make it no longer, you know, I don't deserve to be called an amateur anymore, but I don't have any professional connections. Netflix made a mistake. They're not putting my stuff up anymore. Well, and Netflix changed, right? When Netflix was a fly by night, just a shoestring operation, were you used good,
yeah, back when
people.
The day when you would order, they had send it through the mail.
Yes.
And in
those days, they were honest.
Same thing with YouTube when it first started out.
Absolutely. Same thing with Google when it first started.
Yeah.
But once they become established moneymakers, and it's
the formula.
There's a book by Jack London that I want to recommend. Jack London is a guy, he was famous when I was a kid for writing Call of the Wild, but he wrote a book called The Iron Heel. And chapter 6 is called The Mathematics of a Dream. And you can find it online for free. But he talks about how the billionaires have, they collect so much money every day that they have to have an army of people looking for things for them to buy.
Yes.
Right? So they just, they are driven by the need to do something with this money besides have it collect dust in the vault to buy up everything that there is. But, you know, if we're going to buy up everything that there is, let's buy up pharma and then manipulate things so that we make money off of it. Let's have COVID. So,
and let's we'll kill people. Let's reduce the population because they all are, in essence, they all practice eugenics.
Well, we have to eliminate the retired population.
And that's the other one, which
with the people who are making us money, we can afford to have around. But once they start collecting retirement, like Trump said, you don't cut Social Security. You have to find another way.
That's right. And Operation Warp Speed.
So they found another way. Anyway, so there's getting back to October 7th.
October 7th.
You know, it's kind of unnecessary. But, oh, I was going to mention that on September 11th. Oh, and Jim Mars, who's another much more well-known JFK researcher, he and I both communicated on September 12th. This was an inside job. Well, we had the Kennedy assassination, right, to teach us.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
So when you got that under your belt, you look at the headlines and you're not looking for what the headline says and you're not looking for the message of the article. You're looking for the details that they figure you won't pay attention to and won't recognize as demonstrating, for example, 50 minutes before the Pentagon was struck. Anyhow, let's see. Oh, I was going to mention. So the Rothschilds are the founders of Israel. The Rothschilds are the guys. So there's some brilliant woman, and it's in my video, some brilliant woman sitting in a little audience with some responsible member of the government on the stage. And she says, how is it that this little country, Israel, is able to completely control Britain and the United States and get away with genocide and without getting a peep out of either one of you? And they have controlled the U.S. economy since 1776, and they have controlled the British economy since they've completely controlled it, right? They bought they bought Park Place and what's the other one?
Boardwalk.
And they bought up everything else. They owned everything else, but on 1825, they put a couple of hotels on Park Place, and then they loaded the dice so that everybody lands there. Anyhow, and they want Israel because they want to have the Mossad. They want their own army. They want their own intelligence services. They want right to have an army of slaves that they can dictate.
Yes. Yes.
So that's why they want Israel. But so 1829, they tell the Sultan, we want to buy Palestine, and he says no. They manipulate things so that the British give it to them in 1917, but now you got to get Jewish people to go there.
Yes.
And, you know, in 1917, Einstein is a star, Freud is a star, Mendelssohn is a star. Who's the actress? Anyway, the leading actress in Europe, and if I could remember her name, you would say, oh, yeah. Anyway, Jewish artists and intellectuals and philosophers, Spinoza, and on and on and on, they dominate, is not perhaps the right word, but certainly they had an unfettered right history of success in Europe. Europe has Vienna, it has Berlin. Oh my goodness, Berlin in 1917 was the art center of, I'm sorry, in 1930, just before Hitler came to power, in 1930, Berlin was the art center of Europe. Paris, London, why would anybody want to go live in Palestine? Well, you might go there for summer vacation, right? The Gaza Strip was a thing in 1930. It was a beautiful, beautiful place, luxury hotels. Anyway, but they couldn't get Jewish people to move there. So they had to start to promote the myth, you'll pardon the expression, of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
We just saw that they put Hitler in power. And here's, so there's all these indications, and I could go on and on and I won't, but well, I've been interested in the Holocaust and studying it very carefully for a very, very long time. And I've known, oh man, in East Los Angeles, there was a huge, very, very significant Jewish population, and my families and their families and everybody in East LA got along very, very, very well. Right. Lots of very good and close and many warm feelings towards lots and lots of Jewish friends. I celebrate Jewish culture. You know, Mel Brooks, right? I celebrate Mel Brooks's Jewish culture.
Well, I think before you go into the Holocaust in the sense, what needs to be pointed
short, but go ahead.
What needs to be pointed out is this: the divide and conquer, the separation, the division that was created, the need to push people to go and colonize that strip of land would never have happened without a force behind it. And this is what you're going to set up for. And the fact is, people that grew up in America who've been here for, you know, generations, or who came in earlier generations, they don't want to leave. Most people do not want to leave. They like their Manhattan or their Seattle or their Phoenix or whatever. They love living there. Why would they want to go to a strip of land called Israel? It's, you know, there wouldn't be a reason for it, especially we're talking back in the day that you're talking about. And so in Europe, there was a huge, huge millions of individuals who are from Jewish descent who live there, who are living their lives. But what's going to move them, and what's going to create a, what is going to propel them, is what you're saying, to go into Palestine and convert it. And that's what you're leading up to, is the fact up is that regardless of everything, I'm just saying they couldn't, there would be no need for it. I mean, look in the 20s and you look at all the wonderful music that was being created in America, that in the movie industry, people living here had it great. Why, they didn't want to go
goodness.
There.
Right. Jewish people founded Beverly Hills.
They founded Hollywood. Let's be honest.
But,
there's a whole book.
They founded Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
That's no joke. Right. The racist billionaires, the Harrimans living in Pasadena, wouldn't let Jewish people move into Pasadena. So they moved in. They created Beverly Hills out of whole cloth. And everything you've heard about Beverly Hills, well, that Jewish Hollywood made Beverly Hills.
Yes, because these are just the normal, what I call the normal people at that point in time that were just like anybody else. You had your Catholics, you had your Jews, you had your Protestants, you had your Muslims, whatever. The same thing was going on in Palestine. All these groups were getting along just fine.
Oh, yeah.
It is this small group atop that have a power structure, and they use these are us as fodder, cannon fodder. They needed to get those people over there because, by the way, they weren't going to move over there, but for some reason. So now with this backdrop, there wasn't a need. But again, you had to create, just like World War I created a, something to set up for a World War II.
So they were trying. They created the Zionist movement.
Yes.
But it wasn't popular.
No.
Not to mention that the Zionist leaders were
Well, the Stern gang
people
were
could
the
tell.
Stern gang
no.
were we just did a whole thing. I did a little bit of the Stern Gang and the whole group of those. These are just genocidal criminals. Oh. Al Capone,
yes.
and Meyer Lansky.
From square one, right? Hmm? Their first move is genocide.
Yes.
Anyway, but so I come to find out that you've heard of pogroms, right? Pogroms.
Yeah, they were in Russia. And...
Well, they it turns out, and you know, in my best research, there was one, and you can find this on Wikipedia. This, right, in mainstream history, there weren't many.
No.
There was one. The Tsar was furious at the perpetrators of it. The stories in the press were that 120 people were killed. Well, Wikipedia will tell you that it was actually 40. And if you study it, it sounds like 9/11. It sounds like an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many crisis actors there were. There may have been fewer than 40 deaths. But they blew it out of all proportion in order to try to drive Jewish people to Israel.
Yeah.
But then, so I was mentioning that, I'm not a Holocaust denier. I take, as a teacher for 30 years, right, I would take my kids to the Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, and I would take mine to the non-Rothschild Holocaust. There's two. And one of them is Rothschild, and they're racist and would treat my kids bad. But there was another one that we would go to where they were very, very warm and, you know, just as good. And there's plenty of memorabilia. And the guy who was doing the talk, who was a survivor, I gave him a ride home. Or did he give me a ride home? I forget. It doesn't matter. I think the kids came on the bus and this guy agreed to give me a ride home. So we got a chance to talk. And he was a 9-year-old kid getting chased all over France by the Gestapo. And he told me that he couldn't understand why the Gestapo, you know, they're losing on the Russian front. And the Gestapo is chasing a 9-year-old kid, you know, from house to house to house. And they never caught up with him. But they were always, you know, they would visit the house that he had been at after he had left. And, you know, so he was terrified the whole time. But why? And the only answer that I can come up with, you get revealed to you. There's books on the subject. I used to have it right there. But there are people who have looked at this fact that when World War II was over, Jewish people sometimes were able to find the bank books of their murdered parents. And if they took them into the Jewish banks demanded to see a Gestapo death certificate, and they wouldn't, there was no such a thing, and they literally chased them out the doors.
Oh, so they didn't even take care of their own.
They made $30 trillion off the Holocaust.
All the artwork,
because there was
stolen.
Typically, there were no surviving relatives. Typically, right, on the rare occasions when there were surviving relatives who on the rare occasions were able to find a passbook or a proof of a life insurance, whole life insurance, it's really a lifetime deposit, nest egg. On the rare occasions when survivors were able to find those things, they were denied them, but typically, the reason the Gestapo and everybody else tried to exterminate the entire family was so that there would be no such claims, so that all of the deposits would devolve. Is that the right word? I don't know. But that would end up becoming the property of the banks. And the estimate that I saw I don't know that they could prove this figure, and it was their best guess, but, you know, it doesn't matter how many trillions it was, right? If it was 1 trillion or 40 trillion, they are the only people who had a motive for the Holocaust. The Germans were losing World War II.
Yes.
It was over. The Americans had entered the war.
Yes.
When they held the Wannsee Conference and planned the building of the camps and called for the engineers to design the ovens, they were losing. The only they had less than zero, and they're going to divert trains and soldiers to carrying out the Holocaust. It doesn't make any sense from anybody's point of view except the bankers and the Zionists, who then use this to push people into Israel. And you and I talked. I don't remember the Yiddish or the Hebrew word, the Zionist word for the agreement, but you can find it. It was called the Transfer Agreement in England.
Agreement.
There's a book on the subject called The Transfer Agreement, where the Nazis made deals with the Zionists to deport the richest Jews of Europe to Israel with their money, so that Israel not only got these people, they got their money. And what is the Nazi motivation for doing this? Well, the orders came down from upstairs. Well, who upstairs has a motivation for doing this? The Rothschilds. It turns out we learned in 1932, right? And through 42, the Rothschilds are funneling money to create and support Hitler.
I want to interrupt there for a moment. My brain just fired in a different way. I know what you're talking about, but on the other side in the United States, during the same time, 120,000 plus Japanese Americans were rounded up, put in prison camps all throughout the Western United States. I just went to last year I went to a place called Minidoka, Idaho, which was one of them. About 10,000 people would live there, families. They were rounded up, taken away from their homes, from their farms, from their businesses, from their enterprises. They were put out in these camps, and after 4 years, they were released. They didn't get a stitch of anything that they owned. They didn't get any of their houses. They didn't get their businesses. They didn't get their farms. They had to start all over again. Where did that go? Where did that money go? All those resources. You just hit something that I need to do some research, because who got those properties? Who got those businesses? Who got the farms? Oh my goodness, the same thing was going on here in the United States. And that is something that no one has gone from that point of who got all the assets.
No, that's true. And inside traders, I'll bet you anything.
But I'm just saying.
No, but I'll bet
120,000 people rounded up, held for 4 years, and they didn't get any of their, they didn't get recompensed at all.
No, they lost everything.
They lost everything. Who got those? And actually,
well,
the government sold off actually the area in Minidoka. It was nothing but old lava beds and sagebrush and dusty. And what they did is that for 4 years, they went in and they were overseen, and they actually created irrigation wells, rivers, you name it, and they completely transformed that area, 30,000 acres, into lush farm country. And when they were released, they sold those. The government sold that to farmers, Anglo. So I'm telling you, this is going on. This is going on in our own country.
Yes, but they sold them, but not without going through the hands of the speculators.
That's it.
Right? The inside traders who knew the whole thing and were standing there.
Buy
it first and then double the price and sell it.
I'm just saying the banksters. Behind the same group over here, because they had already reports. They have legitimate reports that the president knew already that these people pose no threat to America whatsoever. But they did it anyway. It's the same people. We need that. Do it. Go ahead. Let's go back over to Palestine now. Sorry.
I think we did. As far as I'm concerned, you know, people can watch the movie.
Yeah, I want people to watch it.
This has been a very good conversation. This is I got to go. And I don't feel the least bit guilty that I haven't said more. If they want to know all of the details, it's all in the video. The Balfour Declaration is in the video. The proposal to the Sultan to buy the Palestine is in the video. And all of these veterans screaming about the murder of Israelis, soldiers and civilians by the Israeli Defense Force.
Yes.
I mentioned this on September 11th. Two planes crash into the World Trade Center, kill a couple hundred people. But that's not enough. That's not a figure. The American people are not going to be mad enough about that. We got to kill some more. So they send in the firemen, and then they blow up the building.
Yes.
In order to inflate those numbers. And in my video, you will see that they sent helicopters to this music festival, and the helicopter pilots confess to the Hebrew language newspapers about how they massacred these festival goers in their cars. And then you can see, it's just crazy video of all 200, I counted roughly 200 incinerated cars. And most of those cars had incinerated people inside of them. And then they talk about how the tanks, there's hostages held up in the kibbutz, and the tank comes in and fires a shell into the house and kills everybody. And this is covered in the Israeli papers. They had to cover it because there were so many witnesses that but they have to pretend, I don't know what they pretend. Oh, it's the fault of the guy in the tank who fired the shell, and it's the fault of the helicopter pilots. They weren't receiving orders from above. Well, anyway.
Oh, you mean
like
you,
I'm saying? I it's all.
I gotta
there.
Let people, you go. I.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. I really appreciate it.
I want to. Just as a brief before we go, the shooting. No. The shooting of their own people reminds me of what the ATF did to Waco, Texas, and the Koreshians. They went in there and they literally exterminated 70 people on our own land. So, folks, I just say thank you so much, John, for coming on. I learned a lot, and I'm going to check out your videos. We'll be in touch, I'm sure. And guys and gals, I just want to say thank you for joining me, for coming on the Lion Zone and watching this. And if you like me, make sure to share with all your friends. And until next time, this is Steve Johann saying, be a lion and not the prey.